Welcome to the Royal College of Physicians Edinburgh Clinical Conversations podcast. Each episode within this podcast series, we delve into a different medical topic with an expert speaker to join us. If you want to find more about the Royal College, then please do head over to the RCPE website and have a look at the education stream and see if membership would work for you. It offers a host of educational updates and activities such as the evening medical updates, the Royal College Symposia, and many more. Please don't forget, if you listen to our podcast, to give us a rating on one of the podcast platforms or subscribe so that it can come directly into your podcast stream.
Hello, and welcome to a special edition of the Royal College of Physicians Edinburgh Clinical Conversations podcast, specially recorded for this year's World PB Day, which is on Sunday the 24th of March. My name is Ben Warner, and I am a Respiratory Medicine Specialty Registrar in the East of Scotland, currently at a programme while I complete a PhD in multimorbidity. As I mentioned, we are recording this podcast for World PB Day, which each year is commemorated to raise public awareness about the devastating health, social, and economic consequences of this infection, and to step up efforts to end the global TB epidemic. It marks the day in 1882 when Dr. Robert Koch announced that he had discovered the bacterium that causes TB, which opened the way towards diagnosing and curing this disease. Although, at least in high-income countries like Scotland, we often think of it more as a disease of the past, TB is still very much a global epidemic. In 2022, 10.6 million people fell ill with TB and 1.3 million people died of TB globally. However, the global efforts to end TB have saved an estimated 75 million lives since 2000. And this year's theme of Yes, We Can End TB is one of hope that despite recent setbacks, not least COVID, turning the tide against TB is possible. I'm delighted today to be joined by Dr. David Connell, who is a respiratory consultant at Nine Wells Hospital, Dundee, where he has a special interest in complex pulmonary infections and TB. He is co-chair of the Scottish Health Protection Tuberculosis Network and is a clinical service advisor to the British Thoracic Society Multidrug Resistant TB Advice Service. David, welcome.
Hi, Ben. Thanks for having me.
I wondered if we could start today with you telling us a bit about your background and how you became interested in TB.
Okay, so many moons ago, just under 20 years ago, I was what they used to call a senior house officer, now a kind of an FY2 IMT1, at a hospital in Northwest London called Northwick Park. And I didn't go there with any particular intention of getting interested in tuberculosis. But I was fortunate to work with a couple of amazing physicians, Jeff Passfall and Rob Davidson. And Rob Davidson in particular had a passion for the care of patients with tuberculosis. This was in the late 2000s. When at the time, London in particular was experiencing extremely high TB rates. They'd been rising the decade prior to that. And TB services across London and large urban centres in England in particular were seeing a lot of cases of tuberculosis. And Rob Davidson ran the TB service there at Northwick Park. And I was really, really fortunate to be able to work for him for 6 months, go to his TB clinics, and look after patients on the ward with him. And his enthusiasm and inspiration as a physician, and particularly understanding the complex mixture between pathology and immunology that you get with tuberculosis, really got me hooked. And then after that, I was again lucky, very serendipitous. This was MTAS, when we were all given an extra year of training, in a sense, and I was moved to a hospital called St. Mary's in London. I was keen to do respiratory medicine. That's where I thought my future lay. And I was, again, extremely fortunate to work for a doctor who I consider to be, you know, my closest mentor in medicine and a friend, Professor Onmin Khan, who led the TB service in St. Mary's and has since gone on to be chair of the British Thoracic Society TB Specialist Advisory Group. He chairs the Clinical Advisory Service for Multidrug Resistant TB and has been chair of the Joint Tuberculosis Committee in the UK. And his amazing approach to patients was humbling and great to see. And then he got me involved in TB research. Fortunate to do a PhD with him and Professor Ajit Lalvani at St. Mary's, where I was able to kind of explore TB immunology, TB research, and spend a lot of time in the TB clinic with Ajit and Onmin and learn from two really good physicians. And all of that meant that I got really immersed in a condition and with the patients who were suffering from this condition. And it's always fascinated me since then. So that's how I got into it. And I guess we can talk about why it's fascinating as a medical condition during this podcast.
Brilliant. That's a really nice introduction to some of the different components of it. Obviously, the disease itself is complex and has so many interesting interactions with its host, the human, but the lived experience of patients, it sounds like, really stuck with you. It'd be great if we could talk a bit more about that. Coming back to the more clinical side of things, so TB is a complex disease that's evolved alongside humans for millennia. Many of our listeners will think of it classically as a cavitary lung infection, but we know it can affect the body in a multitude of ways. And I know you've sometimes described it rather as a lymphatic disease with respiratory spread. Do you think you could expand on that a bit and perhaps explain how that can help us understand its pathogenesis and some of its clinical presentations?
Sure. So that lymphatic thing I mentioned really came from an amazing editorial from a paper that came out about a decade ago. And the reason that people said that in that editorial, it was on a review of a paper on some TB science, was that when you are exposed to TB, and this would be from someone who's got pulmonary TB, you can't, inverted commas, catch TB really unless you've got it in your lungs or in your larynx. If you're exposed to someone who's got one of those infectious forms of TB and you breathe it in, it goes into your lungs. And the TB bacillus is about 2 microns in length, which is the right size to get inside a 2 micron aerosol, the one that people cough out and hang around a room. If it's a smaller aerosol, it's going to get blown away. If it's a bigger aerosol, it'll fall to the floor. But 2 microns are this kind of Goldilocks size that can float around a room. And TB, I guess, has evolved to fit inside these aerosols, which float around rooms and which you can breathe in and get to the lower parts of your airways. And that's important. I guess if it was bigger, it might get stuck up in the upper part of our airways and cilia and so on. But it gets to the lower part of the airways. The bacillus gets engulfed by usually a macrophage, could be something like a neutrophil or even a dendritic cell. And then those cells break up the bacillus and present bits of the protein to lymphocytes. And this process happens within the lymph node, and that's where the immune response is created. And this is really important because this process takes 8 weeks on average to happen. Now, if you get exposed to something like measles, chickenpox, you're going to be able to detect an antibody response much quicker than 8 weeks, sometimes 2 weeks, I think, right? So 8 weeks is a long period of time for the immune system to get switched on. And that's because the bug has mechanisms to delay the ability of our antigen-presenting cells to get the lymphocytes to recognize them and to switch on the specific immune response. And then that 8 weeks allows perhaps a niche to occur within the lung and within the lymph node, which is why TB has evolved to be such a persistent pathogen amongst humankind over the last 50,000 years. It's well adapted to delaying the onset of immunity and to living inside human cells. And then oftentimes because of that, when TB reactivates, sometimes the first signs we'll get, often in patients who have no symptoms at all, will be lymph nodes that are a bit bigger. And sometimes you can see this on a PET scan even that might be done for other reasons. You'll see hot lymph nodes or even a trauma scan done if someone's been involved in a road traffic collision. You'll see large lymph nodes and you sample them and there's TB there. The patient's got no symptoms. And that's why sometimes I like to think of it almost like a lymphatic disease that gets in and out of the body through the lung.
Fantastic. So it can lurk in other parts of the body. It can present in many different ways. Many of our listeners will be working in internal medicine, general medicine, and maybe the first clinicians to raise suspicion of TB in a patient. So could you describe some of the presentations that we might see of TB, for example, in the acute medical unit? When should we have a higher suspicion for TB? Are there particular groups of patients we should suspect it in?
So when people get infected with TB, as I say, it exists in this niche within cells. And the vast majority of people, when they've been infected, never then get sick themselves. They're either fortunate and they clear the bug, or in probably most cases, they don't clear it, but the bug goes into a form of hibernation, some dormancy. We call it latent TB infection. There's almost a stalemate, if you want to use a kind of a battle analogy, between the body's immune system and what the bug is trying to do. the bug switches on some genes called dormancy genes, which means it can exist in periods of low oxygen and with little access to nutrition. The human host has got no symptoms, and 95% probably of humans infected in this week will go through the rest of their lives with no symptoms. The bug will not wake up again. Call that latent TB infection. Now, some individuals are much more likely for the bug to wake up, and those are the individuals that we need to identify and who may be more likely to have TB. So I like to think of three groups of people who are at risk of TB waking up. And these might be people then that you'd think about if you're seeing people in outpatient clinics or at the front door. The first group are people who've recently been exposed to TB. It's worth asking people, have you ever met someone with TB? And you'd be surprised. It could be a long time ago or it could be recently. You're more likely for TB to wake up if it was a recent exposure. So someone might say, yeah, my flatmate last year had TB. If you don't ask, often this information will not be volunteered. But it can also be really historic exposures. And as you get older, your immune system becomes a bit more senescent. And I've certainly seen quite a few people who will describe really significant exposures to TB as a teenager, maybe 50 or 60 years ago. And then they've had latent TB for all that time. And as they get older, their immune system is more senescent. It wakes up. It is worth asking about older exposure, although more recent exposure is probably a more significant risk factor. Second group of people would be people who have got immune suppression. Okay, and that might be something like HIV, where you lose, in particular, CD4 T cells, which are a really key component in tuberculosis immunology. Or more commonly nowadays, it could be people who are given iatrogenic immunosuppression with cell-based immunotherapies such as anti-TNF drugs. So that's important too. And the third group of people where TB is more likely to reactivate are people who've come from a high-incidence country. Could be somewhere like, say, India or Indonesia. And then they've come to a low-incidence country like Scotland. And there's something about the act of migration that means that TB is more likely to reactivate within probably the first 5 years. We don't know whether that's due to stress or lack of exposure to TB, which means that the immune system becomes maybe unpracticed, or lack of vitamin D perhaps. So those three groups are the groups where TB is more likely. Those are the people that we screen for latent TB infection, but they're also the groups where TB is more likely to wake up. So that's the kind of epidemiology of perhaps where TB is going to be people where you suspect it. It's also more likely in people who have got diabetes, who've got problems with alcohol or drug misuse, or come from higher deprivation areas of Scotland. So TB is more common in all of those groups. That's the epidemiology, but then you need to think about what kind of presentations might people have. And I just tend to split this up into two things, really, the kind of constitutional or systemic symptoms and signs people might have, and then the ones which feature the organ involved. So constitutional and systemic things might be things like weight loss or night sweats or feelings of malaise. The more organ-specific ones will depend where TB has affected. Now, as you've said, TB can affect any part of the body. It can affect the brain, the eye, skin, kidneys, liver, gut, literally anything. Around 50% of cases, approximately, in Scotland, affect the lung. And the other 50% are a mixture of those other organs. So if it's affecting the lung, people will often have a cough and a fever. And they might cough up blood. If it's affecting another part of the body, it depends what that, you know, might look like. So if it was affecting the gut, you might have abdominal pain. If it's affecting the brain, you might have headaches or even seizures. So putting those things together, but most importantly, having a really low index of suspicion is what you need to look for. And then when you come to the imaging, there'll be certain things that are going to be important. So if it's on a chest radiograph, particularly in the upper lobes, looking for things like cavities, or on a CT scan, seeing cavities and a particular pattern we call Trienberg. So putting epidemiology, clinical signs, and imaging together gives you your index of suspicion, and then it's about getting the right samples off to the lab.
Just before we go on to those steps about confirming the diagnosis, say you've got a patient who's come into maybe your ambulatory unit with some of those constitutional symptoms, then your chest x-ray shows some cavitary lesions in the apices, and maybe they've got hemoptysis. What other differentials do you need to also keep in mind alongside TB?
TB is not a common disease in Scotland nowadays, right? So there's maybe 300 cases a year approximately, maybe slightly less, say 250. And most of those are concentrated in Edinburgh and Glasgow, okay, so our large urban centres. if you went back 100 years, people with a cough and a cavity, although, of course, Padula just had x-rays, but let's say a cough and some weight loss, TB would be the most likely cause of that. Nowadays, of course, in Scotland, with TB being much less common, the pretest probability is lower and other things are relatively more common and therefore more likely. So you have to remember, and I think that's one of the key things actually about being a physician who's interested in TB, is that you look for TB a lot. You'll find it when it's there, but you will also inevitably need to remember that you're looking for other things too. So other things that, for instance, in the lung would cause a cavitating pneumonia could be a bacterial pneumonia that's just gone on for a bit longer, and things that cause bacterial cavitation would be things like staphylococci, streptococci, klebsiella. Fungal lung infections like chronic pulmonary aspergillosis, which often actually takes advantage of old cavities formed by TB. Malignancy, squamous cell carcinomas, particularly cavitate. Another important group of things like vasculitis. So what we tend to do is take all this together, often send off tests for many of these things at the outset, because all of these things are important. If you've got vasculitis, it's important. If you've got lung cancer, it's important. If you've got TB, it's important. So it's really critical not just to go down one path, keep an open mind, and send off the right samples, whether those be blood samples for vasculitis or sputum samples for TB or a range of bronchoscopy if that's what's required. So those are the kinds of things I think about when I see people coming in the front door. So particularly things like cancer, fungal infections, and tuberculosis. Of course, I should have said other non-tuberculous mycobacterial infections. So these are the other mycobacteria. There are maybe 140 of them, which exist in the soil, in the water, which we're all exposed to and don't cause disease in people with inverted commas normal immune systems. But if you have a damaged lung from COPD or scarring, can take advantage of that niche and cause lung infections which resemble tuberculosis. Aren't infectious to other people, but can certainly cause significant symptoms and may require treatment too. So we call those NTM lung infections.
And I suppose when you're talking about the history as well, you'd mentioned if you don't ask, you're not always going to find out about their contacts, relatives who may have had TB. I suppose it's important also to ask the patient if they've ever had TB. You mentioned about, you know, old TB cavities that could become infected with fungal disease. If they've had TB before, how would that change your approach to them?
This is important. Let's say you've got tuberculosis, and let's say that it's sensitive to all our first-line drugs. Even if you take all those first-line drugs, a small proportion of people will get TB again, particularly if you've got a lot of disease at the beginning, because there's so many bacilli there that there is a statistical chance that not all of them are going to be killed. And then if you don't take your TB medicines consistently, that would increase the risk of it not being completely dealt with and so on. And of course, if you've got bacillus, which is not sensitive to all the first-line drugs, then that in turn is harder to treat and more likely to recur if treatment is difficult to manage. So the first thing when you think about if someone's had TB in the past and they present with new symptoms is, could this be TB again? And then, of course, if you've been treated before for TB and it's come back, that increases the chance of it being some form of drug-resistant TB. And then that's, in turn, harder to treat because treatment courses are often times longer. That's what I think about. But then, of course, if you've had a cavity and got lung scarring, it might not be TB. It could be aspergillus disease. Globally, the most common cause of chronic pulmonary aspergillosis, which is where you get often a fungal ball, a mycetoma within the lung, is in an old TB cavity. And that globally is one of the reasons that people with TB often long-term, even when the TB is treated and cured, have longer lasting health problems. That's a really important thing to remember, that once the TB's been treated, that's not the story over for the patient often.
Since we're on that point about the actual experience of the patient, I know obviously you've treated many patients with TB, but I know you've also spent a lot of time talking to patients about their experiences of TB. So what kind of impacts can this have? How does this affect the patient beyond just the symptoms of the actual pathology?
Yeah, so of course people will feel sick. That's a big problem. And in some parts of the world, in some communities, there can be stigma around having TB. And sometimes that stigma, you look back to historic times within, say, Western Europe, and in the 19th century, this concept of the inverted commas heroic consumptive, you know, the John Keats figure. So communities in all parts of the world have long memories of what TB was like then and is like now, and how it's an infectious disease. So because of that, some people feel a stigma. It's difficult to share with colleagues or with friends and family. And in part as well, in more recent times, in places in sub-Saharan Africa, the TB epidemic has been driven in part by infection with HIV. So in some places in the world, having TB might mean that that is almost a marker for having HIV. So some people would feel they don't want to talk about having TB because people might make assumptions. So there's a sense sometimes of stigma, and that can be difficult to manage. But also, people with TB are sometimes not able to work because, you know, health practitioners will say, look, you have to stay off work for a certain period of time until we feel that you're no longer infectious to other people, particularly if you've got pulmonary TB. Now, in Scotland and in the rest of the UK, we've got a system that means that people are supported by public health if they can't work. And some of that support can be financial. But if you're in employment which is precarious, not being able to turn up for shifts for 2 weeks might mean you lose your job. And sometimes as doctors, we forget that although we might say, look, don't worry, we'll support you, we can even help you financially, if those 2 weeks means that you've lost your job and there aren't any other jobs to have, then that's a really difficult thing for patients. So there's issues around employment, there can be issues around stigma, and then there can be issues as well about the volume of tablets people have to take. And that's really, really significant. There's lots of good visuals you can find online about the number of pills you would have to take for a 6-month course of fully drug-sensitive tuberculosis, and it's amazing. And that's really difficult for people, and particularly if there are drug interactions and so on. So for lots of reasons, outside of the illness itself, having TB is difficult.
Thank you. I think that's a really important thing for us to bear in mind whenever we're seeing patients we suspect TB in or who we know have TB, that there's huge ramifications for them and their family, their relatives. You mentioned about treatment and the simple pill burden. Perhaps we could talk a bit more about treatment of TB. I think many people will be familiar, but it might be worth just outlining what the standard first-line treatment is for fully sensitive TB, what that entails and what you need to think about when you're starting someone on it.
Most TB in the United Kingdom is sensitive to all our first-line drugs. Okay, maybe 10% of cases you might have resistant to one of the drugs, most commonly isoniazid. And then a much smaller proportion, 1-2% might be resistant, what we call multi-drug resistant TB, which is in turn much more difficult to treat. But if you look at fully drug sensitive TB, we normally treat people with 4 drugs for 2 months, and that would be rifampicin, isoniazid, pyrazinamide, and ethambutol. Although if you know at the very outset that it's fully sensitive, and sometimes that's because you've already got culture results, the ethambutol is kind of extra and it can drop out and you can actually manage with 3. But we usually give 4 because we don't, in truth, get those culture results confirming it's fully sensitive often until 2 months into treatment. So we use these 4 drugs for 2 months. And then if the patient's getting better and it is fully sensitive to the key drugs, particularly rifampicin and isoniazid, then at that 2-month period, we stop the ethambutol and pyrazinamide and they continue on the rifampicin and isoniazid for a further 4 months. So it's 6 months in total. There's been studies to try and shorten treatment of drug-sensitive TB by changing in new drugs like moxifloxacin and getting the treatment course down to maybe 4 months. There's some studies shown that, particularly in some forms of pediatric TB, that is likely to be safe and effective. There's no definitive evidence in adults, and certainly nothing in our guidelines that say in adults that we can do that. The drugs, rifampicin, isoniazid, ethambutol, pyrazinamide, are ones that most physicians are not that familiar with. People will often use rifampicin for staphylococcal infections. But the other ones, certainly people would very rarely have encountered before. All of them can cause side effects. Ethambutol famously can cause an optic neuritis. So before starting people on TB treatment, we test their vision and we test their color vision, because the first thing you would often lose in an optic neuritis would be your red discrimination. And if you're colorblind, if you're red-green colorblind to begin with, then that may be an issue. Isoniazid can cause peripheral neuropathy, so we supplement all our patients with vitamin B6. Pyrazinamide can cause a rise in your uric acid levels and a gout. And rifampicin, isoniazid, and pyrazinamide all can cause problems with your liver. And sometimes this can be very serious indeed. a drug-induced liver injury, and it can go on to lead to liver failure in a very small proportion of cases. So because of that, we check people's liver function before they start, and always at 2 weeks after starting treatment to make sure that they don't have even an asymptomatic rise in their liver function or a change in their liver function. And we advise patients to contact us urgently if they are experiencing lots of vomiting or if they notice jaundice. And this is really important because DILI and liver failure, although rare, of course, can have devastating outcomes.
Thanks. That's a very clear overview of first-line treatment. In terms of adjunct treatment, we've looked after patients before with some of the complications of TB, things like pericardial TB or pleural effusions. And I know us in TB meningitis, we sometimes use steroids. Perhaps you could talk a bit about the role of steroids in TB treatment.
This is one of the really interesting things about tuberculosis, is that a lot of the illness caused by tuberculosis isn't caused by the bug itself. It's caused actually by our host immune response to the bug. And if your host immune response is different, then the disease presents differently. So for example, if you've got advanced HIV disease, where your host immune response is, inverted commas, weaker, then the way that TB presents in the lung is different. You are much less likely to, for instance, have cavities. So cavities are, in a sense, part of our host response. And it's this sometimes over-exuberant host response that can cause problems for people with tuberculosis. Now, if you've got a really over-exuberant host response, immune response within the lung, that will cause a lot of consolidation and so on, but that will get better, okay? But if you've got a really exuberant host immune response in an area which is anatomically difficult, such as around the heart or around the brain or within the brain, then that host immune response can actually be the thing that causes the most pathology. So for those reasons, if you've got pericardial TB or if you've got meningeal TB, then adjunctive steroids are usually given alongside the antimicrobacterial drugs to dampen that down. Fascinatingly, I think about a decade ago, there was this lovely study which was done in both zebrafish, which can be infected with something called Mycobacterium marinum, and also in humans, showing that actually the effect of steroids was not consistent in all individuals. And in fact, if you had a genotype for a gene which encodes a group of compounds called eicosanoids, prostaglandin, if you were homozygous at this allele in one direction, steroids were really beneficial. If you're homozygous in the other direction, steroids were actually harmful. And if you were heterozygous, it had overall no detrimental effect. So overall, in this population, steroids, if you gave it to enough people, would be beneficial, but some people would be really harmed by them due to their genotype. And, you know, when we go back to the COVID pandemic and we started using steroids to help support treating an infection, we'll also know that some of those people will really benefit and some people won't. And I think this speaks to this wider sense of host-pathogen interaction, which is not consistent in all individuals, and where some people will benefit from things like steroids or anti-inflammatories for their TB treatment, and some people will be harmed by them. And it's difficult to know from looking at patients who that might be. So perhaps the future for these kind of illnesses is better phenotyping of patients who have got a really exuberant host response and who might benefit from dampening that down a bit.
I think that's such a fascinating area, a window into the future, perhaps of more precision medicine, and maybe one day when we can more precisely identify our patients' genotypes or phenotypes, be able to tailor the best treatment to them. That does highlight how complex managing TB can be, not just in the choice of treatments and the management of their side effects, but also we mentioned about the social and financial implications. So often that coordination of care is done under a multidisciplinary team. Could you perhaps describe a bit about what the makeup of that MDT might be, what teams need to be involved, and for the general physician at the front door, who do they need to speak to? Who do they need to get involved for a patient that they diagnosed TB in?
MDTs, in the broadest sense, started in the United States, I think it was the 60s or 70s, with what were called tumor boards, right? So if you got cancer, it was realized that the wisdom of crowds, in a sense, meant you were going to do better if you were discussed as part of a team which involved people of different strengths. And I think it was in the 80s where there was a TB epidemic in New York. I think that's when TB MDTs were first used. And now they are a core part of TB care within the United Kingdom. And it's part of key performance indicators that patients with TB should be discussed at an MDT. And the reason for that is that within an MDT, and the one we have here in NHS Tayside is a good example, is that you've got people of diverse skills and strengths who are able to support patients across all parts of their disease. And as we've talked about, TB disease is not just about illness in the lung or illness in the gut. It's about social aspects, financial aspects. So the key members of the MDT would be physician, and that would usually be a respiratory physician or an infectious diseases physician. You'll have people from public health or health protection. And in many parts of the UK, you'll have a nurse who is from health protection, what we call a specialist TB nurse. So they specialise in the health protection needs only of patients with TB. Now, in Scotland, because we have low rates of TB, oftentimes TB nurses are working within health protection and doing other things as well as TB, and that's the case in NHS Tayside. But in essence, the nurse caring for the patient with TB is the absolutely key person who will guide the patient through their journey and is usually the person who has the most contact with the patient with TB, and they will often be the individual who will contact them if they've got problems, who will help manage common side effects of drugs, check they're getting their medications, and help get them to appointments and help manage some of the social aspects. The other thing that health protection and a TB nurse would do is do the really important contact tracing. So as I said earlier, TB is a disease that is transmissible to other individuals, particularly if it's in the lung or in the larynx. What TB control is centered around is trying to interrupt chains of transmission. So what you will do is you'll find someone with infectious forms of TB, and then you need to find out if they've infected other people. And what health protection or TB nurses will do is they'll use what we call a stone in pond model. So if you think about a stone being dropped in a pond causing ripples that spread out, they'll go to each ripple and see if there's been TB transmission there and then move out until they can find no more TB transmission. So they'll often start in the household and they'll find out, has anyone else in the house got TB infection? And it's really important to identify TB infection in kids, particularly because they're at risk of really devastating forms of TB. And then they'll look at close contacts within the house, so, you know, partners and people who share a lot of room air, because that's what's key. And if they find that there's TB infection in the house, then they'll say, okay, so looks like TB has been transmitted here. Could it have been transmitted elsewhere? And then that's where they do really clever, intelligent gumshoe detective work, and they'll find out the kinds of places that the index case the patient's been. You know, do they share a car with someone? Do they share a small office? And actually, when we think of transmission, people might not spend that much time at home, but spend all their time in a poorly ventilated office with someone else. And it's that person who, in fact, has got the TB infection, not necessarily the person at home. So the TB nurse is really central to the MDT. We have a specialist pharmacist here, and she is absolutely amazing at helping support the really complicated drug interactions that some of our patients will have. So rifampicin in particular is an inductor of cytochrome enzymes, which means that, for instance, your steroid dose after 2 weeks of rifampicin is in effect halved. So pharmacists helping to manage side effects and drug interactions are really key. We'll have social workers sometimes involved in highly complex cases. And again, for really complicated cases, particularly people who come from backgrounds for alcohol misuse or who are refugees or seeking asylum where they need more support, a social worker is a really key part of the team. We'll have radiologists sometimes look at cases, and microbiologists and the reference lab, even if they're not directly involved in the MDT at that time, are a really important link for us in terms of clarifying some of the diagnostics that our patients are going through. But having all these people meeting regularly and regularly discussing the cases and their contacts is a cornerstone of good quality TB care. Other things that can be done actually in a wider sense is in parts of the UK, there's things called cohort review, where you might go to another team's TB cases and review their cases with them. And it's almost like peer support to help people make sure that their TB services are offering what might be, you know, the best standard gold quality care. Making sure that all TB patients in the UK and in Scotland in particular, for me, have access to things like MDT approaches and peer review, I think is going to be really important as we move forward in the next 5 to 10 years of TB care.
That's really encouraging for people to know there is this whole team there to support the patient. I think sometimes there is an anxiety when faced with a patient with TB about what do we do about public health? What do we do about contact tracing? Perhaps just knowing that if we can link up the patient in front of us with a member of the TB MDT, then all of these other moving parts come together around them.
Absolutely. If at the front door you think, have I got someone with TB here? Whether you're in general practice or in a hospital, knowing in your health board or your trust, who are the people that deal with TB, that's almost all you need, right? Because what you need to be able to do is contact them. And it could be a TB nurse, could be health protection, could be a respiratory physician, an ID physician, even a pharmacist. Like I said, they're a key part of the MDT. If you flag a case to them, then locally, that should activate a kind of a series of communications that will embed the patient within a TB program. So, you know, I think it's down to organizations to make sure that they have robust ways of that notification process happening. But that is the case in most places, I think, nowadays.
I suppose thinking more about what services there are across Scotland and the nature of TB in Scotland, perhaps we could end on some of your thoughts about TB elimination in Scotland. I know that's something that you've been very motivated by, this idea that although eradication of a disease, like, for example, polio is talking about it on a global scale, and that is far from on the horizon for TB, at least on a country level, on a low incidence country like Scotland, there is the possibility of eliminating TB. How realistic do you think that is? How might it be achieved? And what do you think we need to do to get towards that?
So to kind of set the scene behind this, prior to the COVID pandemic, the World Health Organization had set a really ambitious target of eliminating TB globally by the mid-2030s, I think it was. I can't remember the date now. But the reason that this was an ambitious goal, because obviously TB, we have 10 million cases, over 10 million cases of TB a year around the world, and a million people still die of TB a year. But it's not an impossible goal. And the reason for that is that we do have tools, imperfect tools, but we do have tools that can do this. So if you think of TB disease as an iceberg, with most of the disease under the water, and that would be latent TB infection. So most people with TB would have latent TB infection. And estimates might suggest even a quarter of the world might have latent TB infection. A much smaller proportion, as I said before, would get sick with TB. That might just be 5% of those latently infected individuals. And if you want to eliminate TB, you've got to find all the people with active TB who are sick. You've got to find them by having robust health processes that you have, x-rays that work well, and microbiological systems that can detect TB, and systems that allow effective TB treatment. So if you manage that bit above the water, that active TB, if you treat all of that, you're actually not going to eliminate TB, because you've got this huge iceberg under the water of people with latent TB infection who at some point in their lives are going to become actively ill. So the WHO said that in order to eliminate TB, we need to have robust ways of identifying people with latent TB infection, particularly those who are going to get sick in the future. Now in Scotland, that would be people who have recently been exposed to TB, people who are on biologic drugs suppressing their immune system, and people who've come to Scotland from higher incidence countries. So the WHO said, we want to do this globally. But of course, Scotland is much further down the path of TB elimination. And that doesn't, by the way, mean there's never ever going to be another case of TB when it's eliminated. It means it's eliminated as a public health concern, right? But Scotland's much closer to that than many other parts of the world. It might even be in what you could call a pre-elimination phase. You know, we have 250 cases a year or so. So for Scotland to be able to get to this ambitious goal, and I think it should do, because it doesn't feel like it at times. We're a wealthy, developed nation that has the tools and the healthcare systems to be able to do this. We need to have robust ways of identifying our cases of TB, but we also need to have a process for managing people who have got latent TB infection and who are at risk of reactivation. And I think that's going to be the next step. So in England, they've for a few years now had a really good process for identifying people coming from high incidence countries with latent TB infection who are at risk of reactivation of the TB waking up, and treating them before they get sick. And the treatment at that point is much easier. It's not 6 months, it's just 3 months. And my old boss, Ajit Lalvani, has done some amazing research. First of all, showing that this is cost-effective at a health economic level, an effective way of treating TB. And in the last couple of years, has actually got real world data to show that screening people when they come to the UK for latent TB infection and treating them before they get sick is an effective, cost-effective way and an acceptable way to patients of preventing them getting TB. And if we want to eliminate TB as a public health concern from the United Kingdom or from Scotland, that is going to be key. That's difficult though, because, you know, that's going to take money and resource and systems. But if any country in the world should be able to do it, it should be a nation like United Kingdom or a country like Scotland. So I think that's an ambition, but it's one that we should try to meet. And certainly the Scottish TB Network, having a screening program for latent TB infection is one of its top priorities now in a priority setting document that was made last year. And that's something that we're going to look to try and develop over the next 2 to 5 years.
Fantastic. A tour de force of an overview of TB. There's so much more we could talk about the pathogenesis of it, about the treatment of latent TB, and in fact, even the concept of latent TB, which I know is a contested one too, but I think we'd better wrap up there. I want to say a huge thank you from myself and on behalf of the college and our audience for your time and your expertise. I hope we can hear more from you on TB at some point in the future. Thanks very much, Dave.
Thanks, Ben.
The TNMC sister podcast, Career Conversations, supports medical students and trainees with career guidance and progression, as well as professional development. We wish to recommend our Demystifying PACES podcast series on career conversations. As some of you may know, in late 2023, MRCP UK updated the PACES exam format, so we developed this new series to support PACES candidates. Episodes cover exam organisation, calibration, every PACES station including key changes, and candidate perspectives,